Shakespeare is performed almost anywhere on earth in just about any language. He's not lost. Indeed, he's discovered in translation. There are Russians convinced Shakespeare was, in fact, truth to tell, a Russian. Really a Russian. Ditto Germans, so enthusiastic about the bard, they can't believe he wrote in any other tongue but theirs. That doesn't mean putting the 400-year-old texts of the greatest writer in our language into Greek and Bahasa and Japanese and Icelandic is easy. It's about as hard a task as translators face. Getting the meaning right is only a start, argues Daniel Hahn in his book, If This Be Magic, The Unlikely Art of Shakespeare in Translation. Translators, he says, have to find a way of making another language do precisely exactly what Shakespeare is doing, always, absolutely, all of the time. A translator himself, Daniel rather modestly defines what translators are on about as the peculiar alchemy of turning gold into gold. He's here for the Sydney Writers' Festival, and he joins me now in the studio. Daniel, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks so much, David. I'm so pleased to be here on Late Night Live.
Henry V's stirring words before the Battle of Agincourt. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. Now, what could be easier than translating that?
In one sense, that line is very straightforward. The meaning of it couldn't be easier to understand. We few, it means people who are us and limited to the people who are us, and there are not many of us. But one of the things that's difficult about it is that Shakespeare is able to do that in two syllables because English happens to allow you to construct this little phrase that is we few, and then we happy few, and then we band of brothers, and it all fits into a single metrical line. And so while it's not hard perhaps to think about conveying the meaning of that in another language, when you're translating, you're also thinking about the rhythm of it, and in this case, the economy of it. Trying to do we few in almost any other language without stretching it, you know, because you don't want Henry V to be twice as long as it is. Great play, though, in fact, of course it is.
Enough is enough.
And yeah, I don't think, you know, we love Hamlet, but you don't get to Act 5 of Hamlet and go, I wish there were a couple more hours of this.
Yep.
And so in that particular line that you mentioned, one of the issues is however simple the language, however straightforward you'd think it would be to convey the meaning, you also have the challenge of economy. How do you do something that Shakespeare does because English works very well with monosyllables. If you're trying to do that in Portuguese, you're going to be in trouble.
But another thing Shakespeare is doing there is a monarch speaking plainly, which is so beautiful. Now, how do you do that in another language?
Well, that's the other thing, that so much of the time, I think also people assume somehow that Shakespeare is always going to be grand and flashy and flowery and poetic and, you know, big words. And actually, it's incredibly striking how often there are moments like that where when it comes down to the thing that's important, we're talking in really plain language, whether it is a monarch who is actually not, you know, using massive fancy words to talk to the troops, or example I love, which is the end of King Lear, which is just like one of the great moments of drama. King Lear wanders on stage with his dead daughter, and he doesn't talk in big, dramatic, you know, theatre words. He says, why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? Those are all monosyllables. They're all really simple words, like English, you know, an early English learner would know those words. But actually, the simplicity of them and the monosyllabic nature of them is part of the point. For a translator, that's part of the challenge.
But this shifting from voice to voice, which you describe so often and so beautifully in the book, also includes the shift in English from Latinate English to Anglo-Saxon English. And the book reminds us that, well, there are these two fundamental Englishes that we deal with all the time. And Shakespeare's choices matter, don't they?
They absolutely do matter. And Shakespeare, as a great writer, this is not a new or controversial opinion, I think. Shakespeare is a very great writer.
I'm going to tear you to pieces on this.
Go on, yes, go on. Bring it on. My contention is, you know, Shakespeare's pretty good. And one of the things that means is that he's using all the resources the language has. And he's doing things because English allows them. So English has, as you say, the two strands, basically two strands of vocabulary, you know, the Latinate and the kind of Anglo-Saxon and Germanic. And when he's using one rather than another, there is a significance to this. You have characters that will use a loftier language and move moved to a simpler language, which is to say usually from Latin to Anglo-Saxon, or vice versa. They will jump between them in a speech to indicate something. And if you're translating into a language which doesn't have these two strands, you have to figure out, what is it I can do in Turkish? Well, if you're translating into Turkish, you might think, as Emily Ayhan, a Turkish translator, does, maybe I'll use more Ottoman words for the moment where Queen Margaret and Richard III is using more sort of heightened Latin language. But you have to use what is available to you. You can't, if you're translating into Italian, have a mix of Anglo-Saxon and Latin words if all of your words are Latin words.
And then, I mean, the hazards are so extraordinary. Then there's the business of punning. Now, Shakespeare puns all the time, doesn't he? Now is this glorious winter.
Now is the winter of our discontent
made glorious summer. Thank you for the correction. Yes. By this son of York. Right. Now, again, it seems pretty straightforward, but as you point out, it's full of difficulties for translation.
So just within that opening, now is the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by this son of York, if you were looking on the page, you could tell whether I was reading the word son, S-U-N, or the word son, S-O-N. When I'm saying the word to you, you have no way of knowing. If you're listening to the word on the stage, you have no way of knowing. Both of those words make sense in the context of a speech that is about winter turning to summer because of the sun, but it's also the son of York who's doing this, who is the son of the House of York, who is the new king who's making this change. And so when you're a translator, one of the things you have to figure out is, how am I going to make my language, using similar moving parts, if you like, create the effect that Shakespeare is having because English, again, happens to allow them. That one example, actually, because I talked to so many translators around the world who are working on Shakespeare and asked them to kind of explain what I thought were insoluble problems.
These interviews are the book.
Absolutely.
These conversations with translators.
Absolutely. A lot of the book is kind of based around, you know, conversations I had with people in all around the world. It was a huge pleasure and privilege talking to people who were really wrestling with these things.
But so a lot you get of them, these scenes, ladies and gentlemen, of Daniel in Istanbul waiting for a performance of King Lear to begin, or this wonderful, or in New Zealand, waiting for a performance in Maori to begin. Anywhere, really.
Yes, it was an amazing thing. I mean, I in a way, I was just kind of sort of opportunistic. I was working on this book on and off for a couple of years, and I was traveling often for other kinds of work. But anywhere I went, as you said in your introduction, Shakespeare's always on somewhere, and Shakespeare's being translated somewhere. And so I happened to be in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I happened to be in Sofia, Bulgaria, for other reasons. And while I was there, of course, I'm going to sit down with a translator and talk about puns and iambic pentameter.
And while you're there, you're going to go and watch a performance of Shakespeare in a language that you have no clue about. And enjoy yourself.
Very often. And actually, it was interesting. There were sometimes, I mean, I saw a few performances of Twelfth Night, which is the play I know best, probably. And I saw that in Portuguese in Portugal, Portuguese is a language I know well. I also saw it in Budapest, in Hungarian, which is a language I know not at all. But I also saw, you know, footage of a Te Reo Māori translation production of Troilus and Cressida, which is a play I don't know at all. And you have a quite an interesting sense of, I feel like you notice different things. When I'm not distracted by, as it were, distracted by the meaning, which we often are when we're reading, I find myself noticing sound patterns and rhythms and, you know, all sorts of other things that are happening in the writing, which I think it's easy to disregard if the meaning is the thing that you kind of hook onto, which is what we normally do when we're reading or listening to language.
But you say that the translator's job is firstly to get into the guts of a work, to know it intimately, to see every little, I mean, it's an expression you use often, moving part, every little moving part, and to revere Shakespeare, but on the other hand, be willing to be brutally dismissive of Shakespeare when necessary. But how do you make those choices? Or how do translators make those choices?
I think you have to be, in one sense, dismissive when necessary, but it is always necessary in the sense that you're going to have to get rid of all of it. I mean, there's this really peculiar paradox that you're going to, I mean, the way I think of it is when I'm translating a novel, which is what I normally do, my aim is to make a novel that is absolutely identical to the other novel, except for all the words. Apart from the words, I want all of the properties to be the same. I want the rhythm and the voice and the textures and the tones and the humor and all those things to be the same. But I have to do it with 75,000 entirely changed words. I'm not tinkering. I'm throwing away all the words and starting again. And so there is, as you suggest, there's this kind of weird paradox, I think, in what translators are doing, that you're starting from an assumption that everything about this play I want to keep, every little twitch in the meter, every little funny detail of, you know, a syllabic pattern or whatever, I want to preserve all of those things. However, I have to start with a blank page and a completely new set of words and then build something that has the same properties, that has the same effect, but they are not the same 25,000 words Shakespeare wrote. They are a completely different set of 25,000 Swahili words or Tamil words or Italian words.
And maybe if Mr. Shakespeare was absolutely regular in what he did, stuck absolutely to iambic pentameter, it would be an easier task. But, as you point out, his texts are full of irregularities, full of little things that break the rules. And you have to decide, or translators have to decide, whether those irregularities matter. What's your general view on irregularities? Do you go where Shakespeare went?
I think you have to work on the assumption that that most of what he's doing is there for a reason. Actually, if he were writing absolutely regular iambic pentameter all the way through the plays would be infinitely less interesting. They'd be dull. They would be, you know, they'd be less good. But actually, when there is a little kind of twitch, when there is a syllable that's inverted, when there is a line that's only 9 syllables, there's something missing, or there's an 11-syllable line with an extra beat on the end, there is a reason for that. You don't have that sense of Shakespeare of it kind of going regularly de-dum, 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 de-dum for 3.5 hours, which would be incredibly hard to get purchase on. So what you have is, as a translator, you have to notice every little irregularity, think about what the effect of that is, and then think about, well, how do I then replicate that in Danish, which is a completely different language. So when Hamlet comes on stage, he's at the battlements of his castle, Elsinore Castle, and he's been speaking fairly regularly in iambic pentameter, de-dum, 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 and then he sees his father's ghost, and his line is, angels and ministers of grace defend us. He doesn't say angelic ministers of grace, he says angels. So the first syllable is stressed really hard, and it's a way of Shakespeare giving an actor, without, you don't have to think about it as an actor, you can't help injecting a bit of urgency into that. Shakespeare does this all the time. Gallop of
urgency.
Haste, you file it fiery-footed steeds, or look to your house, your daughter, and your... He often does this, the first syllable.
Now is the winter of our
discontent. Now is the winter of our discontent. And so as a translator, if you are translating that as an absolutely regular iambic line, you'll lose something. You're going to be giving your actor one fewer clue for what to do with that line.
Because that's what you argue through the book, that what Shakespeare is doing here is providing clues to actors, and the translator has to work out what Shakespeare wants the actor to do.
Absolutely. The translator wants the actor, wants their actor to have the same material to work with as the English-speaking actor does when they're working with Shakespeare. When Antony and Julius Caesar says, pardon me, thou bleeding piece of earth, that I am making gentle with these butchers. That word butchers is a really, you know, harsh, angry sort of word. He doesn't say these enemies, which means something bad, but it's quite a soft-sounding word. And so if you're a translator, you want Antony to have a word that is kind of spittable in the way that butchers is a spittable kind of word.
And do other languages provide that?
And some do. I mean, you might have to decide, actually, the meaning is not the most important thing. I might translate it as something that means something slightly different in order to give the actor a thing that they can really show their contempt with just because of the particular, you know, clustering of consonant sounds in it. You know, you're giving an actor something to do. And again, the actor doesn't have to think, wait a second, there are some consonants in here. I must remember to spit this one. As these words are embodied by the actor, these words that come through the actor's body, through the actor's mouth and their breath, this is the sound that comes out, butchers. And it's a horrible sound. And if you are a translator in Poland, you want an actor stepping onto the stage in Warsaw to be given something that allows them or obliges them even to use that word in the same way that we say butchers on the English-speaking stage.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Daniel Hahn, who is the author of If This Be Magic, The Unlikely Art of Shakespeare in Translation. Now, Daniel, you are not a purist when it comes to Shakespeare. You're quite happy, within certain constraints, to see Shakespeare's English translated into today's English. But what are the rules for that?
I'm interested in any translation that's attempting to create a kind of coherent new language for a play, which could be translated into contemporary hip-hop, like some productions I've seen, or translated into Polish, or translated into ballet. I'm very happy with all of those things. I adore West Side Story, which is a great translation of Romeo and Juliet into Bernstein music and Sondheim words and orchestra and voice and, you know, and dance. The thing that I find sort of disappointing, I suppose, are those things that purport to be translations that are really focused only on the meaning, that are essentially simplifications, that are saying, we're just going to make it easier for you to understand this, we're going to tell you what this thing means, and that feels like it's always a diminishment somehow. You're getting the gist, but the gist is only about the meaning. I think the occasional, you know, directors and dramaturgs will swap out occasional words, which doesn't make me particularly twitchy. I mean, I feel it'd be hard to make the case that I wouldn't want to swap out any words if I am happy to replace all of the words with Tamil words. So, you know, to complain about three or four English words would be, I think, hypocritical. But I do think there's a difference between those, let's call them translations, that try to find a new language for something, a new language for a Shakespeare play. So a hip-hop Romeo and Juliet I saw, which was set in South London and was very different from the play in some ways, but it was coherent and it was dynamic. It was in a particular language. And it was attuned to rhythm and attuned to poetry and sound and all those things that I think are really important in Shakespeare. And I was infinitely more interested in that than in a sort of, you know, Romeo and Juliet for Idiots, which you can buy, which is just a way of stripping out anything that isn't the clearest conveying of meaning. Because meaning is one of the things that translators are interested in, but there are 99 other things, and meaning is,
as you keep saying, meaning is not enough.
It's not enough. It's not. I mean, I think there are easier ways, like there are more efficient ways of telling the story of Romeo and Juliet than doing it in five acts with, you know, verse and prose and puns and whatever. But the richness of it comes from the complexity, which comes from sound and comes from all kinds of things. One could paraphrase it quickly, you know, if you're in a hurry to get the gist of it.
Like, the gist, yes.
Use that,
but that's just the gist.
But that's not the point, that you don't go just in order to find out if they die at the end, because you can do that on Wikipedia really quickly and save yourself some time. There is something in the substance, there's something in the material of the play.
And the experience of sitting there for that time as well.
And having
time has a role here.
Absolutely. And having a story told to you, especially if it's, you know, you're in the theater, in the room, in real time with people telling you a story, and you can see the breath almost.
Daniel, it struck me reading the book that there are parts of Shakespeare that have dated more than other parts.
Right.
And it's obviously a big problem for translators, but the jokes seem to have dated most. Is that your view?
It's certainly true that some of the jokes have dated quite a lot in 400 years, which I think is fair and unsurprising. Often things get, as it were, undated in translation, though. Often what happens is a translator is trying to make a joke work.
Mm.
And so what they're doing is they're figuring out, you know, what are the moving parts that go into this joke and constructing something equivalent. But it means that essentially what they're giving their audience is not the same as we get watching Shakespeare in English today, but something closer to watching Shakespeare in English at the Globe in 1599, watching Julius Caesar in September 1599. So often the jokes will be newer, the jokes will be fresher in translation, they'll be much closer to what an audience would have experienced 400 years ago. And there are lots of things that I feel, and the more I talk to translators, the more I found there's places where Shakespeare is kind of revived somehow in translation. All the things that are a little bit further away from us, the language which is in some cases a little bit hard to grasp, or the jokes or whatever it might be, even cultural references, just they're nudged just slightly closer to their audience when it is reconstructed for that audience in Italy today.
They're having a better time than us. It's outrageous.
Oh, absolutely. Outrageous. Without question, they have a better time than us. I mean, I would give one just really quick example. There's a scene in Merry Wives of Windsor where there is a Latin lesson on stage, which is almost always cut. I've seen Merry Wives of Windsor many times. I'm not sure I've ever seen that scene actually played, because it's basically full of jokes that are very hard to understand now without a huge amount of explanation. And you can understand it on, you know, in a printed edition because you have footnotes, but on stage you can't say, ladies and gentlemen, let me just explain this joke to you, hang on a second. But you can, as Jean-Michel Debras, French translator, did, build a scene that has equivalent jokes that are very funny. He thought, well, what are the words that when I was learning French, Latin as a schoolboy made me laugh because they sounded like rude French words? He made a list of all those and he built a scene around them, which is kind of what Shakespeare was doing, except Shakespeare's jokes need a lot of sort of extra processing for us to understand them 400 years on. Jean-Michel's jokes are funny first thing, you know, first time you see them on stage in Paris, they're funny today.
Mm. The English language also presents challenges because we use plain words which other languages break down into multiple meanings. The word you, Y-O-U, you, plain. The word love, plain. How do you translate these plain common words and give them all of the nuances of meaning that Shakespeare gave them?
It's interesting because on the one hand, you could say that on the one hand, it's a benefit to have a word that encompasses a kind of huge range of meanings. So I can say, I would use the love, you know, the word love. I love ice cream. Also, my family. Also, Shakespeare, in very different ways. Really love ice cream, but differently, right? And Shakespeare, because English allows it, takes advantage of the fact that love covers lots of different things. And love is different parts of speech. Love is a noun. So there's a line in Richard III about that, for thy love did kill thy love. The first love, for thy love, meaning in order that you will love me, did kill thy love, who is the person you love. That's one word being used in two really different ways. You can't do that in another language or most other languages, but you can sort of take advantage of the opposite. You can be much more precise in some other languages. We can testify much more precisely when a character says they love another character. If you want to in another language, it's much easier to be precise. Of course, it depends language to language, but you can be precise because you have so many different words to choose from.
If a translator has done his or her work, changed every bloody word, and still put Shakespeare on the stage in India or Iceland, why does it work? Why does it work regardless of the culture? Or indeed, does it work regardless of the culture?
I think much of it does. I think most of Shakespeare travels incredibly well. And the reason is partly, I mean, I suppose this is simplifying it, but partly it's that thing that literature always does, good literature or good art, which is you get that sense of something universal, something we can all relate to, because what's being created is incredibly specific. So what he does, you know, there are lots of death scenes in Shakespeare and no two people die the same way, because in reality, no two people die the same way. King Lear dies and Hamlet dies and they're completely different things that are happening to them. One of them is trying to say a few last words. One of them is struggling to breathe because there's, you know, the button on his shirt is too tight. And Shakespeare's doing this partly also because he is writing for actors. He needs to give actors something to do, you know, and it's much easier to act a precise thing than to die in a generic way, which is not a human experience. And so the precision, which comes from thinking about the character and also from using language in that incredibly detailed way where you're aware of the working of every syllable, is, again, it's this funny paradox of that is what makes it easy to relate to. We believe in this universal thing, not because it's vague, not because, well, love is love everywhere and Romeo and Juliet is the same as Troilus and Cressida or whoever, but because it's really particular, and that is a thing we recognise, I think.
Daniel, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
I've been talking to Daniel Hahn, author of If This Be Magic, The Unlikely Art of Shakespeare in Translation, published by Allen & Unwin. And Daniel is out here to appear at the Sydney Writers' Festival.